Every single person is a nobody until they are somebody. For he who believes all things are possible.
Elliot Biznow, the co-founder of Summit Series, which is an iconic global events company for entrepreneurs, visionaries, and world leaders. Attendees include people like Sam Altman, Tim Ferriss, Travis Kalanick, Sergey Brin, and Jeff Bezos.
Everyone has something to give and everyone has something to learn.
What would you say the recipe is to create a remarkable community?
1,000 true fans. All good communities start really small. There's a good saying, the riches are in the niches. Unite the core to build the mass.
What advice would you give to somebody who's going through that imposter syndrome?
Do not try to meet your heroes, and you have to build your tribe. So your tribe is not people who are more successful than you. Your tribe is people at your exact same level.
How did you really build wealth?
Seed investing is by far the best way for any average person to absolutely obliterate it.
How many 100x returns did you have? What is up, guys? Welcome back to the World Class Podcast. Today, I sit down with one of the most inspiring entrepreneurs that I have personally ever met. His name is Elliot Biznow. Elliot is the co-founder of Summit Series, which is an iconic global events company for entrepreneurs, visionaries, and world leaders. Attendees include Sergey Brin, Richard Branson, Sam Altman, and Jeff Bezos. He's also a prolific investor, is an early investor in companies like Uber, Coinbase, and Warby Parker. He was the former co-owner of Powder Mountain Ski Resort in Utah, which he recently just sold to Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, and he wrote an incredible book called Make No Small Plans. And in this conversation, we dive deep into Elliot's story on how he went from a college dropout with no money to building one of the most iconic events businesses in the world. We talk about how to find your purpose, how to overcome imposter syndrome, and really how to build the life of your dreams. So without further ado, let's dive in. Elliot, how's it going, my friend?
Great.
I'm so excited for this podcast, man. Just for context for people listening, about 2 weeks ago, I went on this event called Summit at Sea, and I'm on this cruise, this Virgin cruise, and it was the most epic event I've ever been to. The density of amazing people, right? You've got like the founders of Google, founders of Uber, you have athletes, musicians, you name it, just every incredible person there, and just the most incredible vibe where everyone just connecting and growing and learning. I've never experienced an event like that. And I'm on the boat on the last day and I'm like, I have to figure out whoever created this and talk to them, because it was just so inspiring. And then our mutual friend, Troy, shout out Troy, connected us and found out you were the guy who created Summit with three of your co-founders. And, I think what you've built is remarkable and so valuable for other people to learn from, because I think everyone wants to build community. Everyone wants to build a platform. They want to have impact in the world. And I think you've done that in a remarkable way. So I want to start with your story a bit and dive in. You've created Summit Series, which is a series of events, and Summit at Sea is like your marquee event.
Yes.
But walk us through, where did the idea for Summit Series begin and why did you build it?
Well, when I got to college, I had no money. I grew up in, you know, a home in Washington, D.C., where I had everything provided for me. But my parents were really strict when I got to college. And I was so out of money in college. I was so broke that I had to walk 5 blocks in the freezing cold in Madison, Wisconsin, to an ATM where I could save the $2 fee. And I was also only withdrawing $20 at a time. So experiencing that, not my whole life, but just when I went to college, because I was like out of the family, you know, nest, I was just thinking, this sucks and I'm done doing this. And I got this kind of entrepreneurial bug in my head. I had an entrepreneurial moment my freshman year of college where I saw a kid in my dorm screen printing t-shirts, and it turned out he made $1,000 a month that covered his tuition. And I thought, well, I asked him, who do you work for? And he said, well, I don't work for anyone. It's my own company. I took my own savings of $300 and I bought a screen printing press. I thought this was impossible. Like, I thought I had to get a job up until that point. And I called my parents and they explained, no, you could actually have your own business. So my entrepreneurial, you know, itches, you know, needed to be like, they needed to be scratched. Like, I was ready to be an entrepreneur, to break out. And I spent the next 2 years of college trying to start businesses, both failed. I tried to start a creative consulting company, and I tried to get all of the stores on State Street in Madison, Wisconsin to hire us to have students brainstorm marketing ideas for them, but nobody ever hired us. And I tried to start a t-shirt company with this kid. We didn't sell any funny t-shirts. And then I started a business with my dad right before junior year of college. And it was kind of like Business Insider for commercial real estate. There's a good saying, the riches are in the niches. And people try to start stuff that's like too national or too global, or this big national newsletter or big national conference. And the idea here was, in every city in America, there's this commercial real estate industry. These are all of the buildings that you live in, are all the buildings you use. So it can be restaurants, can be offices. In fact, it's everything except a house. Even condo buildings are commercial, and nobody wrote about it. But if you think about every city, there's hundreds of thousands of people in the major cities in commercial real estate. And even the smaller cities have 50,000 or 100,000 people in commercial real estate, brokers, architects, developers, financiers. And so we thought, what we'll do is we're going to create news and events for commercial real estate, city by city. Mm. And the plan was to go to every city with an NFL team. Well, if they can have an NFL team, then they'll definitely, you know, they'll be a big enough city to be able to create a commercial real estate news and event business. And so I was trying to build this business. We were, you know, it was a free email newsletter. Plus then in the newsletter, we would sell tickets to our events, which was really smart because most media companies only rely on advertising. Mm. So actually the majority of our revenue is ticket sales, which is a much better business to be in. Like, unless you're Facebook or Google, being in advertising is a really hard business, right? It's Facebook and Google. It's all tracked and bajillions of advertisers, every dollar amount, right? It's like really hard if you have any other media company. They all are kind of blowing up just relying on advertising. So I was trying to build this business with my dad, and I realized I did not know anybody. And I was the only entrepreneur that I'd ever met, except this one kid from my dorm. And I realized I also just didn't know much about building a business. Like, I didn't know how to find office space. I didn't know how to build company culture. You could just like go down the list of every single thing I basically didn't know. I didn't know how to put in new technology solutions. I didn't know how to raise money. I just knew nothing. And so I thought, you know, I've read about some other entrepreneurs in like Inc. magazine, and maybe I'll cold call some people I read about. So that idea to cold call is what started Summit Series. And yeah, that was 17 years ago.
17 years ago. But you didn't just pick any people to cold call. You went straight to the top, right? Like, or what was that process like?
Yeah, well, the folks were not famous who I called, right? It was just—
At the time,
not famous.
Okay.
And had little startups.
Who were some of these people you initially cold called?
I mean, the first couple people were Sam Altman, who was— had a company called Looped, which was like a location-based— it was like Find My on the iPhone for like your friends. It didn't work. And then he obviously went to Y Combinator and OpenAI. Blake Mykoski from Tom's Shoes. And he had just given away the first 10,000 pairs. Like, I had read like a little paragraph about it, and I bought a pair. And I thought, I got to meet this guy. And Ricky and Josh, who started College Humor and Vimeo, they were a couple years ahead. And I really, really looked up to them. They had a really fun company culture. I think they had like 50 employees at the time. And there's someone named Joel Holland who would go on to be a really great entrepreneur. And so I cold called these people and I said, I'm also an entrepreneur. I've never been invited to a single event before. Like no conference, no business event. And most of them hadn't either. And so I said, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to rent a house and we're going to have this ski weekend together. Would you want to come? And so the first event, 19 people said yes. And just like meeting our peers was a game changer. Like, I had no peer group. And I think oftentimes people really want to meet their heroes. And I think it's a big mistake, because by definition, somebody who's already really successful just has no time for you, especially if you're not successful. So I tend to tell people, don't try to meet your heroes. It's a really big waste of time.
Interesting.
Like, yeah, you're going to get a handshake and a 1 minute conversation. Like, what you want to do is meet your peers, and then you guys become the heroes, right?
Love that. But these guys ended up becoming heroic figures in the world later on. That's so interesting. So you were starting a business with your dad. There was a need for community. You had no access to information, to mentors. You're like, I don't know. You kind of created your own quasi mastermind, reached out to people that you had saw on the internet, say, let's put an event together. Let's just get our peers together, mastermind and support each other. You organized it. Let's go for a ski weekend. Was that the first summit? That was a free event?
Free event, first summit. And yeah, just going back to the quote of the riches are in the niches. I mean, there were lots of events then. I mean, TED existed and it was very successful, but these people did not qualify for TED, right? And so the niche was, you know, there's a new generation of startup founders really on the back of the iPhone launch and the iPhone app store specifically. All these new businesses now could, you know, blow up on the iPhone, Airbnb and Uber and mobile banking. And every single app that we use today, that app did not exist before 2006. So there's kind of like an app store gold rush from like 2006 to, you know, 2012. And so that first summit was in 2008. And so it was just like all the beginnings of these new startups.
So walk me through how Summit Series progressed. You had your first event, ski trip. That went really well. You had some great people there. How did the next events take place?
The next event was even more of a smashing success. I recruited a couple of friends who became my co-founders. And the next event was in Mexico for 60 people. And in that one, you know, Tim Ferriss came and he had just put out the 4-Hour Work Week. And Dani Levy came and she had built Daily Candy and she just sold it. And it was a big success story. And Garrett Camp and I think, you know, Travis Kalanick came from, they had not even started Uber.
Wow, that's pre-Uber.
Pre-Uber, absolutely. Chris Sacca came pre-Lowercase Capital. He was not yet.
Before he was the multi.
He hadn't even raised the first Lowercase Capital fund. I think he raised that like a year later.
Now, how did you tap into these communities of these legends before they were who they were? Like, were there specific networking groups? Were you just researching online? Like, how did you find these people?
I met everyone through introductions, but I think because it was really frowned upon to be an entrepreneur then, like there was no glory. Like, if you went and told people, oh, I'm an entrepreneur, I have a business, like you got no respect.
Why do you think that is?
Because there had never been entrepreneurial success stories. So it was considered like a foolish thing to do.
Interesting.
Like the entrepreneurial success stories were like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates 40 years ago. Like there was not a new generation.
It wasn't mainstream.
Yeah. Like the only mainstream thing is like successful people work in banking and they make like all of this money. They make like millions of dollars. But of course, like the reason people get paid so much money in banking is not because it's the best job in the world, but it's the worst job in the world. Mm. And entrepreneurship, like nobody had ever made any money. And so there weren't exits yet. So it was just kind of like considered a foolish thing to do to be in entrepreneurship. So all the people who did it, including myself, like there was no glory. Like also dropping out of college was hugely frowned upon. Like now it's almost like people get props for dropping out of school, props for starting a business, props for raising a little money. Like when you did that back then, it was so frowned upon that you really had to be like die hard in your core. So I actually think that the initial group, they're looking back, it makes sense. Like that's why so many of them were successful, because there was no one there for a quick pass or try to make a quick buck. Like everyone knew, like their parents would be pissed. All their friends would like turn their nose on them. And like there'd never been a successful monetary exit.
Right.
So everyone's like, all right, well, I'm still going to roll up my sleeves and go to battle.
Yep. It brought you closer together, but you didn't just put people into a room for a couple of days, right? You were all about creating unforgettable experiences, right? So in the first couple of events, I know you've gotten better over time, but what did you do in the first few events that made them so sticky, that made them so powerful that people wanted to keep coming back?
Well, people really want to meet other people.
Okay.
And the best way to then connect and meet other people is through dynamic shared experiences. So like the worst way would be over a phone call. A better way would be over a FaceTime. A better way would be over a lunch, right? They're getting progressively better, right?
Yeah.
But like the best way is like you and me jumping on a boat in Mexico. It takes us 20 minutes to go, you know, snorkel with, you know,
like whale sharks,
whatever, right? Yeah. Or, you know, dancing together, you know, in a group on a secluded beach. Like these things build like real dynamic shared experiences. And so we really tried to create those in a way that like everyone would immediately be bonded. And so, yeah, that was this event in Mexico. Everyone really connected. And from there, we went, the next event was 120 people and 250 people. And we kind of worked off of, you know, each person would share a couple of relationships and then we would invite more people. And it was like very much, you know, friends of friends only, all word of mouth. There was no way otherwise to get in. Like if someone came, they could refer you. Everyone trusted the referrals.
Yep.
And then the community started to build because on the first event, you know, very few people knew each other before. On the second event, there was a few more connections. But by the time we got three or four events in, there's already now people are showing up with 15 friends and pulling people in. So everyone was now building on their relationships.
That makes a lot of sense. I think that why it is what it is today too is probably because you started with such a density of amazing humans that it kind of just extrapolated out. But I know there was an inflection point for you, right? Because at first you're bringing these entrepreneurs together. Your first few events were free.
Yes. So
that's everyone loved it, obviously. But then there was a point in time where you had to look at this as a business.
Yes.
Like, how do we keep growing and scaling this? We can't just afford to front all this money into these events. But that came with some problems. So can you talk through how you transitioned, what that process was like going from a free events business into an actual company?
Yeah, well, we totally bungled it and it was an absolute disaster. And we, meaning me, I almost blew up the entire community. And I do think that often, you know, to get something going, you know, a brand, a community like you described, you know, there's a great saying, unite the core to move the mass. Mm-hmm. So you really want to build the core. You want to give them these really cool experiences. It could be, you know, pop-up dinners to launch your new restaurant, right? And you're gathering in secret spaces and you have really cool menu and everyone's part of it. And then at some point you have to like flip to the actual restaurant and the pop-up dinner's not, you know, it was free and the restaurant's not. And so, you know, everyone understands like what it means to build a business and, you know, the challenges, but you have to communicate with people. And I think we kind of just took it for granted, like throwing these free events. And then it was, you know, in a one or two, you know, a few sentence email, I wrote, you know, hey everyone, great news. Here's our next event and here's the prices. Click here to buy.
They're like, what the hell? You just bait and switched me.
Totally. In fact, people were so angry. Somebody sent my email to Gawker and, like I made the front page of Gawker as like, you know, the event industry's biggest idiot kind of a thing. Right. So I basically is like the first event was great. The second event was great. I mean, they took work, but it was really just all roses. Like it wasn't too hard to plan. The people kept getting more and more awesome. And I thought, wow, like this is entrepreneurship. You know, it took work, but it wasn't. Like the first company with my dad was really hard.
Yeah.
Summit, it had some little hiccups, but the community concept caught pretty quickly. Mm. Even with me, I was a nobody, like people were coming and it was working. And, you know, sometimes the hurdles can be at the beginning to get your first customer, but other times it can be a hurdle 6 months in. And this was the example that actually, that of course, it turns out it's easy to invite people to free events.
Yeah.
You know, I think, and I spent like 30-ish grand on the first one and the second one, maybe it was like closer to 100 grand. We got some sponsors, but yeah, it's not a very hard invite to say, Chris, I have a free event with all of these rock stars. Do you want to come?
Yeah.
So that actually wasn't the hard part. It's like, but you can't do that forever. And so you have to make this transition.
How would you approach that in hindsight to not have screwed it up and lost the trust of your user base? Like,
yeah.
How would you approach that in hindsight?
I would have done everything we ended up doing, but first, which was simply calling each person.
And letting them know the situation with honesty, transparency.
Yeah, taking 30 to 60 minutes to share with them. Like there's clearly where no matter what would be some people who are like, yeah, look, I'm just not going to come to a paid event.
Sure.
It's not in my budget or it's not what I thought this was. But for the most part, yeah, you just listen to them, talk to them. There was a lot of good feedback we got from people on how to do the pricing. So, hey, kind of like an airplane, there's first class and coach. There's not like six sections. There's like two, you know, so how could we have, you know, really high price points for people who could afford it? How could we have affordable price points for people who, you know, are willing to share rooms, right? So there's a lot of good feedback that we got. Again, going to the airplane analogy where the higher first class tickets subsidize the coach tickets, right? It's like really important. If you listen to like the Ryanair CEO, how he talks about like the incredible importance of first class tickets, like an airplane without first class, all the economy prices go up.
Oh, interesting.
Oh yeah. It's like the most critical part of an airplane because you're charging like 5 to 10 times the price.
Yeah.
And all they don't get 10 times more space.
They're like 20 feet further ahead in the plane with a little more leg room.
right. But then the price, right.
And but then so, that drives the price down for everyone else and it ends up making the business work.
Yeah. So we just got a lot of ideas.
Yeah. That was in retrospect. That was a lot further down the line, but up until that point now you have very angry customers. You've already built momentum and now you're seeing this thing slipping through your hands.
Well, out of like 60 people, 5 people booked tickets from the email.
So that's not a great
and 60 rate. Didn't come back to the next one.
Wow. So how did you rebound from that?
We immediately went to the 5 people. And again, 5 people said, look, you guys are idiots. Terrible email, but the first events were great. Sure. So we get it. Entrepreneurs make mistakes. And like, it's fine. You send me a moronic email, but I'm still in and I have some people who'd really love this. And then the new people, well, they hadn't experienced any of the moronicness. Yeah. They were just in, they were excited.
Yeah.
So all the new people thought, great, I'll, you know, and then what we did was over the next, and it literally took 10 years, we reconnected with, you know, almost everyone who came to those first events. And they all at the right moment when it felt right for them. Mm-hmm. And we had matured, time heals all wounds. You know, they all, you know, returned at some point or another to an event, or some came to many events, or just built back friendships.
Yeah. You had a couple, I would say at least a few inflection points that were really like asymmetric growth opportunities, right? I'd love for you to give us to capture what those moments were in Summit where you just catapulted. I know one of them I'd love to start with is the event at the White House.
Yeah. I mean, the big takeaway is if you're trying to build a community, the best way to get people on board is to give stuff for free. You know, it's such an easy yes from folks, you know, whether it's a dinner at your home or if you have a budget and a sponsor, it's a dinner at a cool place, but it's generally a really cool experience that's free. Again, a dinner at your home, that's nice. How about a really cool dinner and a unique experience that's better? How about, you know, something that's an overnight that's even better, right? So just the power of free, more important than the money, people feel like they feel valued when you offer them something.
They feel special.
Yes. And in order to get people to pay for things, especially today where it's such a transactional world, you're automatically, you know, it's customer and it's the seller. And that is different than when you're offering something for free, you're now gifting something and you can come almost as a peer, if not almost as the person that they're thanking. So it's a really, it's a really good way to bring people into anything. But again, since you can't do things for free forever, at some point you actually have to transition to selling. And so that just has to be done like really, thoughtfully. So, you know, I think within Summit, as we were, you know, selling tickets, we were also getting interesting free opportunities. And it was, people were willing to host us, right? John Paul DeJoria, the founder of Patron, had this epic train from the 1800s that he'd refurbished and he, you know, offered to give us this train for a day and bring 20 people, right? So there's just like really cool stuff like that. We had like a famous person in hip hop who'd often offered to give us their apartment. And, you know, we used that to invite President Clinton to do a fundraiser. And, you know, that was come to this famous person's house with the president. And so, you know, the White House story was, it's the same type of thing where, you know, often, you know, everyone has something to give and everyone has something to learn. And often people who don't have, you know, the ability to give money have connections or ideas, or they can help build movements. Right. And so, just something to really think about, like what can each person give, whether they're your co-founder or they're your friend or they're your partner, or whether, you know, you're asking them for help with your nonprofit or with your business. Like really, I have found that everyone has something. And often the person who like, you know, can donate money or spend money is like ends up being less impactful than someone who can't, but has this amazing network or these amazing ideas. So I had met Yossi Sergant, who created the Hope Campaign with Shepard Fairey, which got Obama, which was, you know, one of the key pieces that built a movement around Obama, right? These Hope posters and pins. And he had ended up getting a job in the White House to, you know, in community engagement. And so part of the idea was, okay, it's 2008, Obama's in the White House. There is this new entrepreneurial movement. There's never been young people running companies before. So therefore, young people have never come as business people to the White House. Like that just didn't ever really happen, as I understand, in all of history. Right? Because there just weren't like masses of 25-year-old and 30-year-old entrepreneurs before. It's just too difficult, right? It's too expensive to start businesses. And now you could just like get these things going quickly. So I had been introduced to Yossi and I told him about Summit and these events we did. And he called me one evening and he said, you know, I know we talked about this. I think we're trying at the White House to bring this next generation in, but I don't have the bandwidth to just, you know, be reaching out to people. I don't know even who to reach out. Since that's what you know, how about we partner and you'll be in charge of curating the attendee list and I'll host the event and I'll put it on. I'll bring the White House officials. Yep. So I said, great, let's start strategizing. When will it be? And he said, well, I got approval to do it, you know, next Friday at noon. And I need everyone's social security numbers and dates of birth by, you know, this Tuesday. And I said, it's Friday. So you want social security numbers by Tuesday and you want the events on Friday in 7 days? I mean, I don't understand. He said, listen, social security numbers by Tuesday, HOP. And I'm like, whoa, it's Friday. So I need to already confirm people what's HOP? And he's like, Tuesday, head on pillow. By the time your head hits the pillow on Tuesday, I need those social security numbers. I need 35 people. Oh, and here's three random people I want you to invite. Good luck. See you there.
That was the big moment. This is the moment that everyone waits for. They're like, everything's on the line. Now, to point out, these were smaller events you're putting on. Now you're throwing a more public event for the White House and you're inviting some huge hitters. There's way more on the line, but the returns you get out of life depend on the level of risk you're willing to take. But this is your big moment.
Yeah, I think in a way they're just, looking back, there wasn't much risk. Like if the event was 10 people, you know, I let down some officials. And there wasn't really monetary risk. And so really the only risk was just kind of embarrassing myself.
Yeah, reputation, with someone. Humiliation.
But yeah, I think, you know, it was objectively big, big upside in terms of building the community and getting access to people who now talk about a cool free event. You want to come to the White House.
Who were some of those people that you ended up getting to come to the White House?
So it was, you know, first of all, we reached back out to a lot of the people who we'd blown up all the relationships. And we said, I am really sorry that I blew up this relationship, but I got an offer to put an event on at the White House. And would you want to come? So we invited 36 people.
Okay.
And 35 people said yes.
Wow.
With 7 days notice. Again, think of how unique this is. No one's ever been invited to the White House in a business capacity. Obama just got in the White House. He's, you know, most famous person in the world. And as soon as these first people said yes, the list became so good. You know, Gary Vaynerchuk and Evan Williams, who is the CEO of Twitter, Chris Sacca from Lowercase Capital. Like, it was awesome. Like, and the list just kept getting better and better and better. You know, Tony Hsieh from Zappos, like amazing people. And then what we did was, it was just like 2 hours at the White House. And it wasn't even like the highest level meeting. But we set up a whole day where everyone got to actually connect with each other ahead of time. We made booklets so everyone could, you know, see each other's bios. We did introductions in the morning. Like, we met at the Hay Adams. We rented a room in the Hay Adams, which is the hotel right couple blocks from the White House. It's like where Obama stayed during the transition. So we had breakfast there. Everyone met each other. They, you know, then we went over to the White House. Then we had a brainstorming after, but it was exactly like the kind of experience at that moment that people couldn't say no to. And then suddenly, you know, rocket shipped our brand.
Yeah, there's a couple amazing things I want to point out. One, you talk about brand co-opting, right? You were able to leverage the White House brand. I know you were initially cold calling, right? And you're like, no one was, you didn't have a great hit rate. And you're like, well, this is Elliot. I have an invitation from the White House. Boom, pattern interrupt. Now you started getting some big people. We were able to leverage that opportunity to co-opt and share that brand recognition. But then also, not only did you set the event up, you went way above and beyond. Right? We have to make this the most unforgettable event. We've got to plan this, this, that. And I think a lot of people would just kind of stop at the first thing. All right, let's just get the event together. Let's just get it done. But you were like, no, we have to make this unforgettable. And you created introductions. But I mean, going like, there's so much gold in that because you made that event so much more memorable, like a 5-star experience. Yes. I think that's the formula you baked into Summit and why I got so inspired to want to reach out to you is there's just something special. There's soul put into this.
Yeah. I mean, all companies have communities.
Yeah.
Right. So it is really the core of every company because all companies have products and those products become, you know, around the products, you have communities. You have, you know, communities of, you know, around each Tesla product of Model 3 owners and Model Y owners and FSD community, you know.
Sub-communities.
Yeah. I mean, within Apple. And these are the biggest companies within every different, you know, within Nike. And these are big communities. But if you look at every company, there's, you know, communities of, you know, the Airbnb renters and then the Airbnb folks who list. And like just every company, like, is around community, right? And then, you know, figuring out how to serve, you know, at its core, like how do you serve the community? How do you give them like the absolute best product? How do you, it's like Walt Disney said, a brand is not a brand until it's owned by its fans.
Wow, that's powerful. Tony Hsieh at the White House told you something that I think was big for the future of Summit. He was talking about, I think he asked you a question like, is there anyone here that you would not have invited if it weren't for their success and accomplishments?
Yes. And I said, there's a couple people, right? Because we've just been trying to get the best
list.
The
biggest names.
And we did that. And we had an amazing list. And he said, so there's some people here that if they weren't successful, you would not have invited. Like he said, is there anyone here if they were not successful, you would not want to invite them to your parents' house for dinner? And I said, definitely, there's a couple people here, like, you know, they're a little standoffish. They're not super friendly. I don't think they're like, right, I wouldn't want to have them for dinner. And he's like, great. Well, if you want to build a community, then those people can't be part of the community, right? Like a community really unite the core to move the mass. Like a community really, everyone has, it's more important to have people who are all about the community, community first, helping the others, than it is to have people who are takers from the community. Mm.
I think that's a really great point because whether it's a community you're building, whether it's a culture you're building inside your own company, we tend to value people with success or they have certain accolades and then we overlook their character traits, right? Because we want to be associated with them. We want them as top producers in our company. But I think Tony was a forcing mechanism for you to look at really how do I crystallize the values that I want to imbue into this community as we scale. So what were the couple things you guys came up with?
The couple things were, you know, is this someone who I would want to be friends with, you know, regardless of their personal or business success? And number two, are they doing something really interesting? And so, you know, whereas before the criteria was, you know, do they have a successful business and, you know, what level of success and revenues of employees? Like a much better question, it turns out, is to build a community. Are they doing something interesting? Mm. Because everyone wants to talk to interesting people. But, you know, if it's all about business, I have this boring company that.
Yeah, I do 17 M&As a year. It's like.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's this much revenue. Okay. It's like a lot of businesses are interesting and a lot aren't. I inherited this business from my father and who cares? but if someone's doing something interesting, just the breadth of now also the amount of people we could now let into the community, cause it wasn't a business community we expanded dramatically. So that was, you know, back in, you know, 2009, 2010, like we already decided Summit wasn't going to be a tech community. So it's, you know, now it's been about 15 years, like Summit is not a tech community and it's never been a tech community. Like Summit is a community for people doing really interesting things that they're really passionate about and they're really nice people. And my brother always says that Summit is the who's who of nice people.
Ooh, I love that.
So that's our two criteria.
But I think that's why you attracted the community you did, because you have the biggest tech entrepreneurs. You have Sam Altman, Peter Thiel, Naval Ravikant, Chris Sacca, Travis Kalanick, Sergey Brin. I mean, you have the biggest guys in tech at your events, but then you also have artists, you have energy workers, you have people who host workshops, you have just such a variety of people. But I think that's what those people want, is no one wants to be in this homogeneous room where it's all people like them. They want to be around interesting people that are living in their full expression of themselves, teaching them new things about the world, but they're bound by a core set of values. And I think that's what you guys nailed.
Correct. The most successful business people and entrepreneurs don't want to generally go to very many events that are for the most successful business people and entrepreneurs. Like, yeah, they have a lot of that in their life. And I think, you know, the best example of that is that the best event in the world, hands down, is Burning Man. You know, I've been twice. It's not quite for me, but it is undoubtedly the best event in the world. And it does undoubtedly attract people and give them an experience that they cannot get anywhere else in the world. And it's not for lots of people, but it allows people to self-select into something that is so surreal, so off the top, that no matter how successful you are, you hear about all the most successful people in the world going, because for those people, there's nothing else like it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, in fact, if you were to say what event in the world has the most successful business people, it would probably be Burning Man.
Without a doubt.
Right? Like,
without a doubt.
You know, and it's not like, oh, I created like Davos America. Like, no, it's Burning Man, because yeah, that's who successful people want to be around. Like, successful people have kids, they're married, they're, you know, they're interested in all the interesting things we are, dancing and music. And
yeah, you're right. And I think too, once you reach a certain economic status or social status, you realize that was never the fulfilling thing in the beginning. And you just want to be the fullest expression of it. You want to be free and experience life to the fullest. And that just doesn't take place inside the logical business world. Like, it takes place through dynamic experiences, like you said, with like-minded people in particular environments that are safe and open, or people are there to connect as an intention versus like, how can I get something from this? And so I think you're right. People are attracted to that. And you really, I think you brought that into Summit in your own way.
Yeah. I mean, from very early, like back in 2010, my co-founders and I decided that the only events we were going to do were the events we wanted to attend. Like, we would not do anything at any event that we did not want to go to. And we were going to build events for ourselves. And when we did our first Summit at Sea in 2011, we had to make this huge, you know, $1 million deposit. And it was like all the cash the company had saved up. And, you know, we hadn't sold any tickets yet. And we always joke, like, look, we're taking the ship for 4 days and it might just be us. It might just be the founders and a couple of team members, yeah, but we're going to have the best time ever. Like, we're going to book, you know, the music we want. We're going to book the speakers we want. You know, we booked the Roots as a house band, and we had, you know, Richard Branson speaking and Peter Thiel speaking. And, like, you know, this is what we want to do. This is the community we want to be a part of. So I think it was so authentic. Like, there was no part of it that was forced. And I think, again, good communities allow people to self-select in or out of them. And that's why Burning Man, it's so extreme. And that's why it works so well. Like, there's a lot of people who are successful in the world, and you don't need most of them to want to come to Burning Man for Burning Man to be a smashing hit. You only need 80,000, right? Just like Coachella doesn't need every one of the billion people who listen to music to come to Coachella. They need 160,000 who are into that, you know, vibe and that music. And like Summit, you know, by doing it on a cruise, a lot of people aren't coming. That's okay. Yeah. But all the people are like, wow, this is what I need in my life. Like, I need like this container where I'm just like, can disconnect from land, and I'm with other entrepreneurs, and there's just like music at all hours, and there's this awesome content, and I'm just like roaming through the hallways and comedy. And we kind of just built this surreal experience that when, you know, the right people heard about it, they self-selected in. And that, by the way, that is the best way to build a community. Is a community should be open to anyone who wants to be in a community. Like, I feel like very strongly that communities like really shouldn't from the inside curate. I feel like that community should create they should create the offering that allows people to self-select in. Like right now in the world, like there's Tesla FSD, and it's not finished yet. So the only people who are going to drive Tesla FSD are people who want to take a little bit of risk. Okay, well, you can self-select into that, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can kind of go through every good community. And, you know, if we're going to build a fly fishing lodge in Alaska, like the only people who are going to go there are really into fly fishing.
Right.
So you're going to have awesome conversations if you're into fly fishing. I don't have to say, hey, you can't come. It's just like, you know, creating communities that allow people to self-select in, because there's high barriers, will create good communities.
That's a really great distinction. While we're on that topic, I think this applies to anyone wanting to build a platform like Summit, build their own event series, their own masterminds, their own business. They want to create community amongst their customers, whatever it may be. You've learned a lot about the right ways and the wrong ways to build community. If you were to package this and say, this is the recipe for how to build a thriving, incredible community behind whatever movement or product or service or group you want to create, like what would you say the recipe is to create a remarkable community?
There's a great blog post like a decade ago about musicians, and what musicians really need is 1,000 true fans, right? And the idea is that with 1,000 true fans, you know, each one might spend like $150 a year, and that's $150,000 in revenue. And also like those 1,000 fans, like if you can build 1,000 true fans, you can build 10,000 true fans. You can build 100,000 true fans. And I think that like all good communities start really small, right? You unite the core to build the mass. You really listen to the community. You workshop the community. You're not a, you know, no matter how big your idea is, Uber spent 2 years in San Francisco and New York before they launched other cities, right? And they really like listen. I mean, it was a thing to take those early Uber rides, right? It was not like so obvious, or to stay in the first Airbnbs. Like that was insane to stay at random people's houses instead of hotels, right? It was, you know, and so those early adapters, those early community members, like these brands really spent a lot of time letting those people build out those local communities. And like those people then again, they start becoming your ambassadors. Like when you have a good brand, a good brand becomes great when the people who buy the product become your ambassadors and marketers. And so the growth does not just have to be like just straight up and to the right. That's why it's called a hockey stick, right? Because you actually spend these years with very little growth, where you're like building out the product, right? You're building out the community, right? You're listening to everyone. You're doing all this high touch stuff, and you're really like getting into the weeds. And then the community becomes like ready to explode.
Mm. Now that you have that community, I think nurturing that community and building the culture and keeping on the right track is pretty challenging, especially as you're scaling too. And what I noticed about the Summit series and the community there, it's a bunch of people that I call quietly impressive. Like everyone's just a very interesting, impressive person I met. But there was this ethos of like, we're here to authentically connect and enjoy life together. And like no one was flexing. The most impressive people were not saying anything about business. Like did you guys intentionally cue or put, did you guys intentionally create anything in the culture to set it off on that track? Or do you think just by virtue of having the right people, it naturally created that loop? Or were you guys intentional about creating the culture of Summit?
Well, I think we're intentional in creating the place that we wanted to be and we wanted to go to. And we're intentional in the people we initially invited, mm-hmm. who then through those people set the culture with like the unspoken, you know, guidelines. You know, also, you know, what got you here won't get you there. So the right. Summit community is 17 years old, and we've had an amazing woman, Jody Levy, and she's been the CEO this is her fifth year.
Okay.
So, you know, like she's, you know, she cultures evolve, right? Yeah. And she's continued to evolve the culture in new ways. And, you know, the community meanders like a river, right? It changes based on, you know, different times we're at in the world, right? And, you know, different interests in the world and how people grow and mature. And, you know, I think when you, like we, you know, the any community's like ethos starts at the top. So if like the very person at the very top is like, you know, wearing a suit and tie, if they're always rushing, if they only care about money, like these things are going to come through with the, you know, who the customers are, who the event attendees are, right? If like, you know, it's the opposite, which is like, well, we just want to hang out at the event with our friends and have the best time ever. We want to try to, like, you know, we believe giving is living. Like these are like our mantras. Like, well, then the people who are going to come are going to be people who kind of self-select into that vibe and that ethos. And then from there, it just kind of, you know, trickles down. And so I think we just, like the event we built, like we didn't have any interest in meeting like really successful people. Like we just wanted to build this awesome event that started like just wanting to meet other entrepreneurs, people we can collaborate with, people we can be friends with.
I like that intention. It's kind of like a living organism and it's like, it's a kid. It's going to be raised and grow up like with the values of the parents and continue to grow that way.
Yeah. And obviously any event company, is the community is much more difficult to manage, than a company that sells a product. Because at the end of the day, like you make a good iPhone, like there is a community around it, but like you, there's, they're buying a product that you're making.
Products are consistent, like, less variables.
But yeah, our product is the community.
Right.
Right. Our product is the people. Like I don't care who else owns an iPhone or who else has a Tesla. I mean, maybe a little bit, but not, I don't think so. Right. I just want my good product. So when you're actually like doing events, it's a much harder thing to get right. You know, being in the business of people, it's like a very nuanced, you know, challenging business, right? Because like ultimately, you just have to be so sensitive.
Yeah. What was the lowest low in building the company?
It's a really hard business to be in events. So you really have to like be in events for like the absolute love of events, right? It's not a super high margin software business. It's, you know, it's not a recurring revenue business, you know, where you collect all the money up front. Like it's, you know, and also every people want to make their plans as late as possible, right? So just like being in the event business, like you're in it because you love it. That's why we've been doing it for 17 years. If we didn't love it, we would have stopped after 5 years or sold it, you know?
Yeah, there's more practical ways to make money.
Totally.
And way less stress.
Yeah. So the good news is like the people who are bought in to the company, like they're doing this because it's just so rewarding to be spending your life building community, being around these inspiring people. You know, and there's plenty of businesses that just like thrive during COVID and then events were like the opposite. It just shut down for 3 years, you know?
Was that like when COVID happened, was there like any existential crisis for you there? Like, I'm curious, was there any like, oh shit, we might not make it type moment?
Well, we didn't, we knew we had to keep the community alive. So we never like accepted that we wouldn't dig out. But yes, because we had an event that was almost sold out in June of the COVID year. That it got canceled 3 months before. And then you spend most of the money building the event.
So now you're in the hole for a ton of money.
Yeah. You have all these, you know, millions of dollars of credits. But you spend the money building it, right? Like, when Nike makes a shoe, like they spend all this money, like designing it and ordering all the pairs and, you know, bringing the shoe to the stores. And then if it's like, oh, sorry, COVID can't sell a shoe. It's like, well, we already spent all the money on it. So most of the money, like there's a little fee for renting the ship, but it's not comparable to like the team that works for 18 months, booking the content, booking the music. And we have a whole team that is building the community, right? So yeah, it was definitely a disaster. But you know, that's okay. That's okay.
I love it. You're like, this is just part of the game though. You just built up this resilience. I'm curious, you had your three co-founders, right? So you have that shared camaraderie, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Jody's amazing.
And you had Jody, the new CEO.
She's really amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know objectively if we, I don't think the three of us could have made it without her. For sure, we could not have.
Well, that was smart of you to realize you had taken it as far as you could take it. Without needing some extra help.
Well, what got you here won't get you there.
Right. And most founders don't transition. And when you realized, okay, the founder to CEO transition is a huge transition. And if you have the awareness, you're like, you know what? This isn't us. Like, we're the founders. We like putting these together, but we're not the CEO of this massive organization now. The awareness to make that right hire, I think, is the only way you get to the next level.
I mean, she's great. She's our partner. She's, you know, when you have a business for 17 years, we don't have like traditional investors. We don't have venture capitalists who need exits. Yeah. You know, as the founder, like you really just, like from the beginning, like all we cared about was the community.
Yeah.
So none of us, you know, were ever arguing about we should be the CEO. We were all aware of our skills and like, we're all just super happy. The community's thriving.
Yeah. It's interesting because your story, just to give people a truncated version of it, it was BizNow Media with your dad, right? You're building that while you're running Summit, right? Eventually you end up selling that.
Yes.
For tens of millions when you're about 30 years old, right?
Yes.
So you're building that business in parallel. So the community led Summit series is not like your cash cow, but it's your spirit, it's your heart. You're building this for the long run, but you have a cash cow you're working on building simultaneously, right? Then you sell the business. At that point, Summit Series is already this massively successful and growing organization where you've got access to incredible people. You have lots of different vehicles. And now you have capital, a lot of capital once you sell your company. And you're able to strategically use those relationships to start investing and looking at different opportunities. Can you talk through essentially how you thought through your macro plan there? Like, okay, because you know that the Summit is going to be your heart's labor, but it's not going to be the cash cow that allows you to live the lifestyle per se that you want to live. How did you think through your sequencing and process of like how I'm going to have that and really build wealth and live my holistically successful life?
Well, we always thought Summit could be a good business. I mean, it's a hard business, but we always thought it could be a good business. I would say the main thing is that I just realized like often things can have second order effects. Mm-hmm. Like you're doing one thing, you're going for a run every day on the beach, you're through your town to be healthy. So you go on this 5-mile run.
Yeah.
And then you notice actually the goal of the 5-mile run is to get in shape, but you actually keep running through a certain neighborhood and you see a certain store and you think, oh, interesting, maybe there's an opportunity there. And that'd be like a second order effect of going for a run every day. Right. Or like the goal of taking a shower is to like get clean. But like the second order effect could be like, oh, I have good ideas in the shower.
Right.
Right. So
yeah.
I think, I put my kid in like a great school and like, that's the goal. And then like, oh my gosh, I met like three families and parents who have become really good friends. It's like a second order effect. So our lives are filled with second order effects, and second order effects are like a very important concept. And I just realized, and my co-founders did as well, when we're doing these Summit events for these amazing people, like whether someone was a good business, medium business or great business, like it is clearly not going to be Uber, you know, or Airbnb. Yeah. But all these people were coming to the events and that they were also all raising money, right? Like we were always like very intentional about not making Summit transactional.
Yeah.
Like we're just like, hey, we're building a community. You can buy tickets to come. And, you know, that's how we pay for the events. You buy tickets, that hires staff, that pays for the event. So if we all come together, we all buy tickets, then we have a budget to put on events. That's it. That's the only thing we wanted to sell the community. But all these folks are raising money for their companies. And we thought, wow, these are like really good ideas. So even before I sold BizNow in 2016, like I took every dollar that I ever made. And I invested the money into startups, and it would just be the startups that I met at Summit. And again, my co-founders did the same.
Who are some of the startups you invested in those days?
Oh, like I said, like Garrett Camp and Travis Kalanick came to Summit before they started Uber. So they were in the hallways at our 2012 event, raising the Uber Series B at a $280 million valuation. And today the company's worth $150 billion. So they're raising like a $40 million Series B literally in the hallways.
So you got into the Uber Series B.
Yeah, there was lots of stuff like that. You know, I did the Coinbase Series B as well. I mean, there's tons of stuff.
Warby Parker, I think you got into as well.
Yeah, the Warby Parker founders were literally raising it's like $1 million at a 5 million post money valuation. There's like lots of stuff like this where,
and it's all happening at Summit at your events. Like they're
definitely, because they're raising money and there's a really good group of people to raise from at the event. So it's not all happening there, but
right. Just natural part of conversations.
It,
yeah.
Definitely part of it. It's like a really obvious place for them to like definitely go. And yeah, there's just a lot of those types of things happening all the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we didn't have like that much money. So we had to do like small checks at first. And then, but we just took every dollar we ever had. Like, you know, it's like, oh, my rent was $1,400 a month. So like, it would be okay if I had like $2,500 in the bank, cause I could like make rent and then I have a little food money. But like, meanwhile, like I was making a lot of money from biz now, like from the time I was 21, I was making a lot of money in sales and, you know, we were profitable in distributions, but I was literally taking all of the money and my bank would have just like a couple grand.
I love the long-term approach from day one, like investing everything back into Summit to grow Summit, all the money you're making from biz now, you're investing into tech startups, like just a serious long-term approach. It's paid massive dividends. You've invested in what, more than about 50 tech companies now?
Yeah, like 100.
100 now? It's incredible. I think like just to capture that for people, I think this, I'll call it a playbook, but I'll just call it like it's a intelligent sequencing of things. You built a business, you were learning skills, you didn't have the network. So you created a community so you could learn and you could share. And that was free. Eventually you started growing that and you turned that into a paid business, but you didn't look at it as your money making machine. You kept your intention pure. I'm going to make an incredible community, keep pouring my heart into these events, make them as good as they can, build this community. I'm going to keep building my business, my cash cow on the side. And then you put yourself in a position where you dug the wells and you earned the trust, respect, and friendships over time to where at the time when you were able to have some capital, you were able to actually get in some investments and, I mean, have a very unorthodox career as a very successful venture capitalist without ever having to work in a VC. You know what I mean? I think that sequence of what you did is awesome. And I think people can learn from that because you had a pure intention. And I think that's what drew people to you because they could tell you weren't transactional. They're like, this guy really freaking cares about building a community. And then off the back end of that, there was ways for you to create win-win relationships there that was not transactional.
Yeah. I mean, lot of luck, right? Like we're in the right moment in time. But yeah, I mean, we would see these people and we could definitely recognize they were much smarter than us. And then asking them if we could invest in whatever they were doing next. And it turns out like, you know, folks want to raise money. And yeah, I mean, like I would always see Naval at the Summit events and he was just so impressive. Always. He was always amazing. Yeah. And then he had this like new crypto Web3 fund that he started in like 2017, 2016. And I just said like, well, I don't know anything about this, but I would love to give you money to invest in your fund. Right. So it was just like stuff like that where, you know, these things turned out to be like smashing successes. And then obviously like I would get educated along the way, but you can, there's like multiple ways to invest. You can either be a master in an industry or you could be like really good at investing into people.
Yes. The who, not how method. So I did the same thing though, because I started in the recruiting industry, then built a recruiting business, and I am not a great investor. Like I cannot underwrite a deal. I'm terrible at looking at unit economics and predicting future growth. I'm just not that guy. But then through recruiting and building executive teams, building engineering teams for early stage companies, I realized that was so valuable that they would then let me onto their cap table and they would take checks from me because they wanted a long-term partner. And so I found my way into venture in a similarly unorthodox way to you, where created value for people and then realized, oh, wait, I have access to the right people and I can't underwrite the deals, but Sequoia, Andreessen Horowitz, you know, the top VCs, they do. And if I can just build the right relationships and add value to them, I can get on the cap table as well. So there's a lot of ways to put yourself in a position to succeed that aren't necessarily traditional.
Yes. And there's all industries of finance, and some industries of finance are exceedingly complex, like running a hedge fund or running a private equity fund. Like on the hierarchy of difficulty, like these are at the top, right? Running a quant fund. But that doesn't mean they're going to make the most money. Oftentimes hedge funds blow up.
Yeah.
Hedge funds are subject to the whims of the actual public market sentiment, right? And, you know, private equity funds have their own challenges. And so within segment of finance, like there's venture investing and then you have like seed investing, series A, B, C, D, right? And like the big higher the letter in the alphabet, like the later the round. And so within venture investing, you know, seed investing is basically the earliest stage of investing. And it's where you have like the highest loss rate, but you also have the highest hit rate. And people, like my very strong belief is that people, they overanalyze what it takes to be a good seed investor. Like you can be an, you can be like the world's best seed investor and you couldn't run a hedge fund. You couldn't run a private equity fund. You're not.
Yeah. What do you think it is? What skills do you need to be a great seed investor?
Yeah. There's just a couple. And if you have those couple skills, you can make better returns than any hedge fund, any private equity fund. You need to be very price sensitive. So you have to like just get a low valuation and you don't even have to overthink it. It's just like paying for a $50 million pre-money valuation. Like even if the company's worth $1 billion after, you know, that's only a 20X. And after dilution, because they raise more rounds, you're probably 10X.
Yep.
So it makes a big difference if it's a 5 million post-money valuation, because that's 100X at a billion.
Right.
And with dilution, it's 50. So 50 is a lot better than 10X. So people are just like valuation sensitive and like do deals at reasonable valuations is a really, really big one. People who have a very strong viewpoint on one industry, like they don't have to be geniuses on the world, but they really know one industry and they just like love it. They don't even have to be brilliant in the industry, but they like conceptually get it. They are good at consumer tech or consumer packaged goods or cybersecurity or AI or cryptocurrency or software as a service. But like any of those, they like, and they're just like obsessed with it. They like love that industry.
Yeah.
And they have like a very strong point of view that there's going to be certain companies in each of those industries that are going to be winners. Like, my thesis was like, I want to look for people who are like me as an angel investor is like, I'm investing in a startups built on the back of the iPhone App Store. Like in 10 years, there's going to be every single thing we do is going to be changed. And I want to find these startups. It was like a very simple thesis. Like, I don't know anything else, but I use an iPhone and I know all these things are coming. And like, I want to find the Bank of America for cryptocurrency. That was Coinbase. I want to find like, oh my God, something's going to fix taxis. Well, taxis suck. Oh my God, eyewear is such a scam. Luxottica owns like the whole eyewear business and every single pair of sunglasses in Sunglasses Hut. That's insane. And it's $300-$400 a pair. I want to pay $99. Oh my God, Warby Parker, that's genius, right? So like I would, that was kind of like my very simple thesis. And then they have to size all of the checks the same way. Like you can't try to like pick winners in the seed.
50 here, 500 here. That's not a good formula.
No, because none of the ones I really thought would win ended up being the winners.
Yeah.
And all the ones I thought were like good might win. Like Uber was just black cars at the beginning. Like, yeah. So if you did that Series B, you're investing in a company in New York and San Francisco where you could get on your phone, you could order a black car.
Yeah.
So that was like, this is cool, better than a taxi, but it was not like, oh my God, UberX and Uber Pool are going to be the thing. And then Uber Eats is whatever, third or half the business now, right?
Yeah.
Like I did not think Uber would be like the one. I thought like, this is cool. This could be $1 billion.
Yeah.
Right? Half a billion. Like we were shocked. They raised around at like 3 billion and it was like pandemonium. We were like, this is wrong.
I just had Emil Michael on the podcast a few weeks ago, but yeah, I think they raised like 15 billion in total.
Right. But at the 3 billion round, we were in shock.
Yeah,
we were
like, oh my God, this can't be this valuable.
I thought it. So those things like low valuation.
Yeah.
And by the way, either you're investing in a fund that they know those niches, or if you're doing it yourself, like you just know the niche. And then you have to be like really well networked. Like there's a lot of people who are unbelievable networkers.
Yes.
Who had a really strong conviction. And I didn't think they were smart enough because they wouldn't be to run a hedge fund or a private equity fund. They just wouldn't. I decided to not invest in their funds because I've had a lot of successful funds I also invested in, right? Because I kind of realized like, oh, well, that's the only niche I do. So if I want to invest in any of these other niches I described into anything in crypto, into anything in cybersecurity, into anything in emerging neighborhood real estate, if I want to invest into healthcare or software as a service, like I definitely can't do any of those. So then I would look for fund managers, And so whether you're doing it yourself or looking for a fund manager, like, don't be on your high horse about how smart someone is who's a seed investor. Equal size checks, they're very sensitive about valuations. They are like really obsessed with an industry and like all in on it. And then the final thing was like, if you're doing it yourself, it's not a problem. But if you're investing in a fund, the fund needs to be small. Like I was doing like $10 million funds, 20 million, 30 million. Like if you have a $300 million fund, well, that's not seed investing, right? Because you have to do like 7% per check. So $300 million, that's like 14 investments. Okay. Well, the average investment, if it's $300 million, is like 30, 40, 50 million bucks, right? So, well, that's not a seed round, right? Like seed rounds are like $2 million or $4 million, right? So yeah, those things were like the secret of seed investing. And seed investing is still today, it's by far the best way for any average person to absolutely obliterate it.
Was that a more lucrative wealth creation vehicle for you than the business you built?
Insane. Yes.
So that's an interesting career path. I guess if someone's out there that isn't coming from our world where they immediately have access to big venture capitalists.
Well, I didn't have any access to any big venture capitalists because I couldn't meet their minimums. You know, these venture capital funds, you have to put in
millions.
Yeah. I mean, the big ones, 25 million, 10 million, but even smaller ones, 500,000 or 250,000. Like the cool thing about seed investing is, you know, you can put in $5,000 or $10,000 into seed investments, especially if you're willing to help a little bit, right?
Yeah. Like there's, I think there's platforms like WeFunder and some other ones that give you access. You don't have to even be, I don't know if you have to be accredited, but you have access to investors.
Totally. You can absolutely do stuff on AngelList.
AngelList, yeah.
You know, again, I never really did anything on platforms. I kind of just like did it through my network. But it's not to say there can't be some big ones on the platforms. Yeah. But like the solution, though, is not like skimming through platforms. Like the solution is you really being passionate about an industry.
Right.
And that is like your niche. You know, I saw some people who are investing in, you know, off-Broadway shows, whatever. Mm. Like it can be anything, right? Like there's businesses in every imaginable
industry. That's a great point. Cause if you're really interested in, I don't know, AI vertical SaaS applications and the different ways AI can, you become an expert in that and you can start hosting events with AI founders like you did and build a community and get access to interesting people.
I mean, if you're interested in cooking, there's every single cooking product I use, literally, if I just look around my kitchen, is a new product. The pans I use are some new company, right? Like I'm not, you know, buying all clad from 50 years ago, right? Yeah, it's like everything's new. Like I use my Ninja air fryer and like, you know, every single, there's the new blender that competes with Vitamix. That's a third of the price, right? Like,
right.
Just like if you're into cooking, like that's a whole world. And so I think, you know, you have to make a little money first because it's like most people just like writing $10,000 checks is a lot. It's obviously a lot of money, but you know, if you can, this is a good like level two.
Yeah.
You know, you've started to have a little savings and like, are you really going to, you know, are you really, the problem with like putting all your money in index funds is like, you really have to start with like some meaningful amount of money, like putting a couple hundred grand into index funds isn't unfortunately going to take you anywhere. Right. It's like by the time it doubles in 10 years and doubles again, well, now the 300 grand is 600. It's worth 1.2 million in 20 years, but there was inflation. So it's really like worth like 600 grand. Like, it's just like, you know, if you've made millions of dollars, it makes sense. But if you haven't, like, doing these little investments, you know, maybe trying to do 10, five or $10,000 checks a year.
Yeah.
Over like 3 or 4 years, you know, you get like 30, 40 irons in the fire. I mean, you know, I had lots and lots of 100x monetized returns.
How many 100x returns did you have?
10.
10 liquid 100x returns by 38 years old?
Yes.
See, that's incredible. And you started at what age?
I started at investing. I started in 2010. So
that's a pretty damn good return. I mean, that 27. That beats most VCs themselves.
Yeah, of course. I had lots of losses.
Sure, but those are
pale. But yeah, like one loss, if you make 100 investments, one 100X wipes out every loss.
Yeah.
So my biggest regret was I didn't do more. Like my biggest regret is I wish I'd been able to invest more money, which I didn't have.
Yeah.
But then I wish I had done smaller investments.
Across more deals.
Because I passed on lots of amazing things.
That ended
things.
Up being huge. I think you gave some really good advice there. And I love what Hormozy says. Instead of investing in the S&P 500, invest in the S&Me 500.
I like it.
Until a certain point, you got to invest in your own skill sets until you're making a lot of money. Invest that into yourself. Invest that into your business. Then when you have a good pile of cash and you put it into index funds or more safe assets, it can compound at a meaningful rate, right? Other than that, like you might as well just invest that back into yourself, take some risks so you can get a bigger pile that then can do meaningful things. But I think people get a little bit too scarce up front and like, okay, let me just put this much into savings. Again, I don't want to give advice to anyone or any blanket advice, but if you really want to build wealth and create an extraordinary world-class life and go big, I think you got to invest heavy back into yourself and take some more of those types of risks in areas that you're educated on. So you really do have to like find an edge and something you're passionate about and get really well networked and knowledgeable in that space. But I think that's really good advice.
Yeah. You know, add that investing in small funds with unproven fund managers is an amazing, amazing opportunity. You know, you can kind of treat the fund like a startup investment. So, you know, maybe a typical fund might have, write 20 or 30 checks per seed fund. So, you know, if you're going to write a $10,000 seed check yourself and you're going to do 10 a year, you know, you could give like 50 grand to one fund. And over 2 years, that 50 grand will be in like 20 to 30 companies. So I have also had just really mind-blowing results with funds.
Yeah.
And I've had five funds where the funds are 20 to 60X on the fund. And that
and the good part too is they're doing all the work for you.
Yeah, they charge fees and carry.
They charge a two and 20.
So they are taking a lot. So it doesn't work to do a fund if it's, you know, they're targeting a 4X and after your fees and carry, it's a 2X. But I have been personally in more than five funds where these funds had 1,000 to 5,000X investments in the funds. So again, that trickles down because each of your investments, if the $50,000 check might be $2,500, but if that $2,500 400Xs and you put 50 grand in the fund, right? Like you start to make big returns. But the most important thing is like these funds were nobodies. Like these funds struggled to raise money. Like I haven't had any successful investment I made was the investment round I did hyped. Like I said, Uber, they were like, I don't want to say they were begging for cash, but like they were raising money in the hallways of Summit. And like Summit was not like the prestigious place to be, right?
Yeah, it wasn't Sand Hill Road.
All these rounds were like, if you wanted to get in, like you could get in. Like every deal I did, all these funds, like they were like, hey, do you have any introductions? Like I have a bunch of funds that I put a bunch of people in and like it was easy to get into them. And like these were not like some famous fund. These were like punk kids who again, like maybe worked for a fund and then they quit after 3 years and started their own and raised $6 million.
There's an interesting pattern here that's really cool. You had no freaking experience, reputation, status when you started Summit, right? The guys you invited who are now icons, the Elon Musks and Peter Thiels of the world, right? You found them at a point in time when they weren't the big hitters they are today either, right? The funds that you've had a lot of success with, once again, they weren't massive funds that had all this prestige around them yet. They were just smart people. You probably knew they're ambitious and interesting markets that they had some sort of edge in. But I think we overhype the big shots in the world right now. But like there's something to be said for the underdogs.
Yeah, well, look, here is the absolute truth. Every single person is a nobody until they are somebody.
I love that. I love that. That's a mic drop right there. Everyone is a nobody until they're a somebody. What do you think? I'm curious. You were talking about in the book a couple of key concepts that I think are really interesting to talk through. You talked about know your definition of success. Because I think we have like a societally programmed definition that most people accept is the path we're supposed to walk. And you talk about the 4-hour work week in there too. Can you share a bit about like how you define success and maybe how Tim Ferriss and that stuff played into it?
Well, I always joked with my co-founders that we wanted to be number one on the Forbes 400 of fun list. You know, like we didn't want to be number one on the money list. Like that sucks. You know, like you're working all the time. You know, and so we defined our own success, which was around, you know, great business partners, a great community and customer base that we were also friends with, you know, great lifestyle and working hours, like, you know, building, you know, a really healthy balance. And then we worked backwards and we made our business fit into that. And, you know, we did not at all costs, you know, focus on, you know, business, money, money, money.
Because I think that's interesting is like, what metrics are you measuring a successful life on? And I think we obviously as a society way over index on financial wealth, like how much of our identities and our happiness we wrap up and how much we W-2, right? And I asked a coach this years ago. I'm like, what is the most important metric to measure a successful life? And he told me tears of gratitude. I thought that was so interesting.
I love it.
You know, it's like how many moments just made you cry? You were in such awe and such gratitude for your life. He's like, that many tears is how great your life was.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and you're like, how much fun are we having? Like, how amazing is the community? And as a byproduct, it's interesting because you weren't as focused on the money. It's not like you were irresponsible and not looking at it, but like you just weren't focused on it. It was there. And as a result, you ended up making a lot more money and having a shit ton more fun.
Yeah. I mean, looking back, the only reason I made these investments was like, wow, these companies are amazing and I want to be a part of them.
I want to be part of that journey.
I want to be on the journey, you know, or this fund is awesome. Like I really want to be in this industry.
Yes.
I mean, I knew I wouldn't get any of my money back for 10 years. Like I just, there was such a low probability of success at the time. Yes. And again, it, you know, it goes back to those initial summits where like we were all of us bonding over like being the only dropouts, being, yes, you know, the only people that didn't have salaries. Like we're all making 60K a year. Like literally, right? Like all, I mean, I'm sure Sam Altman was making 60 or 80K a year. I mean, at a little startup with a few million dollars of funding, like how much could he possibly have been making? I'm sure all these initial people like making 80K, it would have been like insane to make 100 grand a year. Like I can't imagine almost any of the people at that first summit were making over 100 grand a year.
That's incredible.
Right. And they're just there like, I mean, how much could you make? You're at a little startup. Like Travis Kalanick before Uber sold the company for, I think, $6 million or $10 million, right? Okay, like how much could he possibly have been making? You think he raised like a few million dollars and like they paid him 400K?
Yeah.
No chance, you know?
I really like that idea because if I look back at myself too, I was doing Fortune 500 exec recruiting and all this kind of stuff before, and I was bored out of my fucking mind, right? Like I had no passion for bureaucratic big companies. So I sat down and I said, if I'm going to stay in this industry, who would I be inspired to serve? Like who are the relationships I want to build with? And then what skills must I develop to become the most valuable human alive for that person? Right. So I knew it was going to be startup founders, underdogs. Yes. I want to build the next Uber, the next Facebook before anyone knows who they are. And I want to be on their journey. I want to invest in the company so we have skin in the game. And I'm up there in New York when they're IPOing with them. Yes. But I think for me, it wasn't as much the monetary desire. Obviously, I want the returns, but like I just wanted to be a part of that person's journey and to have the camaraderie and to feel a part of something bigger than myself. And you touch on that a lot too. You're like, individuals don't change the world. It's when collective communities come together that change, yes, the world. And that's where I think we derive the fulfillment, the camaraderie. We don't always want the success, but we want the validation, the respect and the love from other people that we think the success is going to give us.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Agreed.
Yeah. I love it, man. What, dude, I have to ask because your stories are so fucking awesome. You had Kobe Bryant at your events. Other amazing people, but I'm curious whether it was Kobe Bryant, Richard Branson, like who were some of the people that you think have had the biggest impact on you that you've met at your events? And I'm curious if you like learned any particular lessons or had any special moments that you want to share.
Well, I think it absolutely turned out that when we built these events that we wanted to attend and we were just like ruthless and like, if we're going to attend, we're going to spend money on the events. We're going to, you know, we're going to make them awesome. Like yeah. That really incredible people wanted to then come because most events, it just turns out, are not built in that way.
Yeah.
You know, I observed that these folks were lifelong learners, like that they were actually, like when Jeff Bezos came to Summit LA in 2017 to speak, he didn't just come for one day. He showed up the very beginning of the day he spoke And I remember him, you know, seeing him in line to get to the front row of a content session. And I remember talking to him and him saying, oh, I'm really excited to see this person, you know, because they've done a great job with their brand. And, you know, I'm very curious about that brand, you know? So, okay, wow, that's amazing. You know, I found the successful people both extremely present and really, really nice. And they just create a lot of space for themselves to think. They're not like always jammed with stuff. And it's always like the lower level people are trying to schedule me like weeks out. Are also often like really unfriendly. They're lower level people. They've been like less open to big ideas. And I'm always like stunned when you finally get to the top and you've like clawed your way through and there's like the gates that you never thought you would get through to get to the top. And you finally met the person and they're just like, yeah, just, you know, why don't you cruise by the office? Any day next week, just let me know when it's good. It's like, well, what about your schedule? It's like, no, well, you know, I have some stuff on the books, but you know, let me know when works and we'll set it up. I mean, so many of the successful people do not have assistants. That is, I mean,
interesting.
They have people doing things for them, but they're just scheduling their own stuff. I know Elon Musk is famous for saying his assistants are too slow and just like putting stuff on his own calendar. But that's definitely what I've experienced. Like there's very few of the successful people who are then moving me to an assistant, which is surprising because they're so much more successful than I am. And they are running really big companies.
But they still do it themselves.
I mean, they prefer to just like, I write them, hey, how's your schedule? And they're like, great, let's do this day at 4 o'clock. You know, call me then. Here's my number. Next topic, add to calendar. Send me a calendar invite and call me then. Next topic, boom. Not like, hey, so-and-so, can you schedule?
They just move fast.
And they also know they move fast. That just always blew me away. Like it certainly seems like everyone has assistants. And like what I saw is like, they really don't. Like again, they do for certain stuff, but not in their interactions.
Right.
I just noticed that successful people really get in the weeds on every important things. Like they don't just like delegate it away. Like they have these businesses, but if it's important, like they know what's happening, right? And again, it's almost like they did 4 months. It's like Elon Musk, you know, again, would sleep on the factory floor. So he knows every single detail, but then of course he delegates and he might, you know, not go back for a while, right? Like that kind of a thing. And I just noticed like all the types of people, like they know every part of the business inside and out. They might've delegated it and have layers of people now running it, but they really know things extremely well.
What did you pick up? Like, what was your experience spending time with Kobe like?
Just definitely a lifelong learner. Like always, I mean, he was famous. Like he would cold call people, you know, that he literally didn't know and say, I'm Kobe Bryant. And the operator would hang up because they thought it was a joke, right? But he would just, you know, he would actually cold email and cold call people to get advice from them. And actually build real friendships. But he was always asking questions. That was probably the biggest surprise. It's like, you know, you think you're with someone, again, so much more successful than you are, than I am. And they would just talk about themselves. And I just found that like all these successful people, they're successful because they're in this lifelong learning mode. I realized like going through the summit events over the years that the successful people wanted to be there just as much as the up and comers. And we had one of our summit, like kind of unwritten rules was, don't snub the startups and don't fanboy the big timers. It kind of naturally happened, right? Because the startups really wanted to meet the big timers, but the big timers actually wanted to meet the startups. And so we really, like enforced that. But I would notice that like, again, going back to Jeff Bezos, I would just see him like chopping it up with all the attendees. And I just thought, wow, like he just could have done his speech for thousands of people and left. And he's just like really in there. And like, he doesn't care if people push his buttons or challenge them. It's almost like they want to be with the customers. They want to be challenged. They want to have their buttons pushed. They want to have their debates. You know, they want to have debates on things. And I think now, X has really given people a chance to hear and to listen, right? Like if you're on X, you're listening, right? You are really hearing what's happening, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's why people who use X and who have used it are so aware of like real sentiment and feelings. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, you're just like kind of on your high horse. Like, here's what was in the New York Times, you know, oh, here's what was in the Wall Street Journal, you know, okay, no, well, here's reality. Like, you know, So I think I've seen the same thing over the years that like, we really have had very few successful people that have just like shot out. Like, we would have like Richard Branson and no one can locate him for the talk. And he's just like, you know, Texas, I guess, you know, person who came with him. He's like, yeah, I'll be there 5 minutes before. And then like, I'm like, man, it's crazy. He's been here for 2 hours. No one knows where he is. And then it'll be like a few days after the event. And my friends will be like, dude, it was crazy that he was just like, you know, in the bar with like, there's like 20 of us just like chopping it up with him for 2 hours right before his talk. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
You know, so I noticed that they would like very good at taking advantage of like being with the people, being with the up and comers, being with the entrepreneurs. Right. Like good leaders are not like in an ivory tower.
Mm, I love that, man. Giving some advice to people on the come up right now, right? I know you're still working on some really cool stuff, but like you've come a long way by 38, you've built some really cool businesses. What do you think? I'm just curious, like, what do you think, or what would you say to the person out there that has these big dreams like you have, but they just get stuck in imposter syndrome? They don't have evidence that they can do it and they're stuck. They have these deep desires in their bellies, but they can't seem to take action, or they sabotage the results. They just don't feel like, they question whether or not they can do it. What advice would you give to somebody who's going through that imposter syndrome?
Yeah, you have to meet your tribe and you have to build your tribe. So your tribe is not people who are more successful than you. Your tribe is people at your exact same level. And then you need to rise with your tribe, right? These are people that are doing, you know, different businesses, but they're in whatever city you're in. They're around you. They're in your city. They're in every city. They're in every town. And you need to unite with them and build your crew. And that's like exactly what I did with my Summit co-founders, right? Like it was us. And that is the key.
That's the key.
That is the key.
Don't go at it alone.
Do not try to meet your heroes. Like when I see the successful people at the events, like I'll chat with them. It's nice that they're there, but like I'm not trying to like be friends with them. I'm trying to be friends with my peers.
And that's very like contrarian to popular social advice.
Yeah, I really strongly disagree with the popular social advice on this. I really think building your crew of people at your level who can problem solve together. And again, you're not going to get like a one sentence piece of advice. That's why podcasts are great. You can go deep with someone for an hour and a half, right? But you know, if I meet, you know, what's going to happen if I meet Barack Obama? Well, I mean, even if he gave me an hour, even if he gave me 2 hours, like it's not going to help. Like what I need is like friends for years who are like aware of my up and downs and when I actually have challenges. I can go to their house for dinner and I can go hang out with them and they're helping out with my, you know, my business or my family or where I'm like, I can call them for, hey, got a quick 5 minute question for you. What should I do about this situation with this team, with this employee or team member, right? Like, what's going to happen if I hang out with, if I'm friends with Dana White? Like,
it'd be a cool moment.
It would be a great moment. And we'd have a great photo.
Right. Instagram would love it.
And it would be great when I saw him the second time. Yeah. And he is awesome. I'm a big Dana White fan.
Huge Dana White fan.
But
Dana White's fucking awesome.
And when I see him the third time, it's going to be great.
But you're so right, man. Cause like even at Summit, you know, I was just there. Like, I met some huge people worth billions and billions of dollars that everyone in any other environment would be lining up to take pictures with, right? Just everyone knows, just be chill at Summit, right? But there was probably three or four people that weren't the biggest people. They were still successful, interesting, awesome people, but like that I know will be lifelong friends that were actually life-changing, right? Yes. It wasn't the big people that were there that gives the clout and status.
Yes, what you can do with big people is with the right person in the right moment, you can make deals.
Yes.
And I have done some of those things. I've met some people way out of my league. I met Reed Hastings, the founder of Netflix.
You bought a ski mountain.
We'll get to that on the next podcast, but I met him and I brought him to Powder Mountain and he bought a home on Powder Mountain and then ended up buying Powder Mountain. You know, I met Ted Turner came to speak at Summit DC 10 and I was 25 years old. And I pitched him on creating a United Nations Foundation Entrepreneurship Council with the next generation of entrepreneurs to pair with the UN Foundation, like global board.
Interesting.
Right. So I have done deals with people, right? Because, you know, there are sometimes can be really interesting synergies.
Right.
I'm not going to be ever friends and like real peers with people that successful. By the way, I've met, say, really famous people and I've invited them to speak at Summit, and it's like super mutually beneficial, right? Like they're coming, they're getting to speak to a great group. We're gaining from learning from them. But still to this day, it's like my peers are like my peers and my friends who give me time. Like if I can't call someone 24 hours a day, anytime I need for real help, and they can't cancel a meeting and they can't focus, like then they wouldn't be like my crew.
Dude, that's a great refreshing distinction, honestly. I think everyone is like on the road to success, is clawing to try to get these big friends to kind of elevate themselves. But like, I like the focus, because you're right. They could be friends and they're helpful. They're mentors. They're there, but they're not like they're there, right? And it's like Naval, who you know well, he says all the success in life comes from playing iterated games, right? The compound interest, whether it's in finances or relationships, right? It's the people that you build with side by side for decades at a time that are the most fulfilling, rich relationships.
Yeah, I think people really respect me for this. And it's very apparent that I'm not trying to be their friends. Like Naval and I have always had a really, really good relationship, but like I'm not his peer. I'm not like trying to be his friend. When I see him, I see him. When he was doing this awesome fund, I called him and I said, hey, I would love to be a part of this. He said, great. Like I got into one of my best fund investments of all time, like thanks to that relationship. But like, I'm not like chasing like friendship with like this person. It's like, dude, I'm super happy following him on X. Yeah. Like yeah. I'm super happy. Like yeah. I just read the, his manual of Naval Ravikant or whatever it is, you know, the book.
Yeah.
Almanac.
The Almanac. Fantastic. I was like, wow. Book.
You know, so that's an example. Like I know my place and I know who I am. And like, I'm really not chasing like big or famous friendships. And so.
Dude, you really made me think on this one. Cause I, you know, what is it? Four years or so ago, I got to spend 5 or 6 weeks with Jack Dorsey, and my buddy was living with him at the time. And going into that, I'm like, I really want to be best friends with Jack Dorsey. Like this is what a fucking cool opportunity, right? I got to spend a lot of time with him. He gave me life-changing business advice that ended up actually changing my business and my life's course. And we had some great memories. But then in retrospect, I'm like, if it weren't Jack Dorsey, would this be someone that is someone I'd hang out with every day and be best friends with? And I'm like, no. Like I admire the guy, I respect him, but like, you can just tell when you gel with someone where they're going to be best friends with you for life. And I think a lot of times because of someone's prestige, you want to force relationships. But I'm like, you know what? Like that was a special moment in time we got to share. And I'm so grateful for those relationships, for those moments and those memories. But no, like we're not meant to be best friends. And I think people go into these things, like including me, and you're trying to force things because like you really want to be close to somebody because you admire them or something like that. But
so I also love, I love having great friendships. I also love having great relationships, right? Like it's always good. Like you built this really great relationship with Jack Dorsey.
Right.
You're going to run into him. You see him. Maybe you get dinner once a year. Right. By the way, you're trading ideas with them. You're brainstorming. Like there is a good relationship, but like you're not talking every month. And I have a lot of people, like we do get together once a year, or when I run into them, like we just go deep for 30 minutes in the corner on like some, you know, cool topic, and I'll share stuff with them and them with me. But like that's a really good relationship and I really value those, but like, I don't push these or want to push these like farther than what they should be.
I think that's a freaking awesome distinction. Got a few last questions and we'll wrap up. You know, Scott Galloway?
No. Oh, I mean, I know who he is.
Professor Galloway.
Yes. I know he is.
He had this really viral talk and I want to get your opinion on this, but you shouldn't chase your passions. He says, don't pursue your passions. That's the fastest way to go broke. He goes, don't pursue your passions, pursue your talent. Pursue something that you're good at and get good enough to where you become passionate about it, but be pragmatic, build a life for yourself. You know, you can easily pursue your passion as a musician. You could totally fail and be broke and have no foundation for your life. But he goes, pursue your talents and what you're good at. Then maybe later you can focus on your passions. What's your personal take on that?
I mean, why can't you apply your talents to your passions?
It's interesting. I mean, most people, I think, pursue goals that are dreams that disguised as pragmatism, right? It's like, they're just pragmatic. It's like, well, I really want to be a musician, or I want to be an artist, or I want to be a podcaster, but I'm going to go work at, you know, DE Shaw and hedge funds, right? Cause like I'm talented at finances, or I'm good at real estate, you know? So I think a lot of people have a hard time owning their passions. They're like, whatever is pragmatic where I think I can make money, I'm going to do it.
So the example would be like, you're really good at sales, but you really want to be a musician. So sure. He would say like, well, go do sales.
Yeah. When you say, fuck it, go all in and be a musician and go as far as you can. Or you'd be like, all right, well, yeah, go make some money, build a foundation, and then pursue that. What's your take?
Yeah. I would go, well, it's so hard to start a business.
Yeah.
It takes so long that you really have to like just love it year after year. So I would go, you know, start a band and be the band member responsible for all the marketing and sales and partnerships.
Ooh, okay.
You know, so I mean, I just think it's so difficult to start things. And you just, the people who succeed, they're at war. You know, they're just, but they love it, right? Because it's like they're true. They really, this is like the thing they want to see. The thing they want to see in the world, the thing they want to do. So I think you could apply your talent to your passion.
I like that. It's an and, not an or.
Seems like it.
I like that. Random question. This is always a fun one. You've seen Men in Black?
Yes.
Okay. You remember that deneuralizer, the pen?
Okay.
That wipes your memory out?
Yeah.
So imagine you're about to get deneuralized.
Okay.
But before you get your memory erased forever, you have to start your life over.
Okay.
You get to write down one piece of advice to yourself.
Ah.
What would you write to yourself?
For he who believes all things are possible.
Where is that from?
When I was 13, I grew up and I played tennis, and I was just starting, and I had a tennis coach, and he gave me a book for my 13th birthday called Jonathan Livingston Seagull. It's an amazing book. It's like the perfect book to give a 13-year-old, but anyone of any age can read it. It's about a seagull who is in a flock of thousands of seagulls, and no seagull tries to like break out or be different. They don't fly over 100 feet. They eat all the breadcrumbs like the other seagull. And there's this one seagull who just, all he wants to do is learn how to fly. So he starts flying higher. His name is Jonathan Livingston Seagull. And he starts flying higher, and they expel him from the seagull pack because it's like so crazy to fly high. And so he goes and he gets expelled. And along the way, he meets a couple other like rogue seagulls, and they start training to be the best flying seagulls in the world, and to break all the seagull sound records and do tricks and flips. And then in the end, they, you know, reunite back with their tribe of seagulls and become the heroes. And, he gave me this book, and in the, inside he inscribed, you know, for he who believes all things are possible. And I like tore the page out, and then I like taped it next to my bed, I slept like on the left side of my bed, and there's like my pillow, and then like right next to it, it's just like I had the page taped and said, for he who believes all things are possible.
Wow, that's powerful, man. I feel like that seagull book was like a metaphor for the summit journey.
Life-changing. That was that moment, and the way he gave it to me and the way he inscribed it. His name was Martin Blackman. And it was really, really life-changing. Like from there to like have that as my foundation was really deep.
That is deep. I love that. Before I ask my last question, where can our audience find you, engage with you online? You're not really a big online guy, are you?
Yeah. You can find me on this podcast with you.
You got to come to one of the summit events.
Yeah.
Which I highly recommend checking out. What is the website for summit?
Just at summit on Instagram, summit.co.
Guys, if you're listening, I highly recommend coming to one of these events. It'll change your freaking life. But last question for you. I think for me, when I think about being world-class and living a world-class life, it's just about constant growth. It's about always seeking that next level for yourself, always seeking that expansion, whether it's in business, your relationships, something, but it's pursuing more and pursuing becoming more. So I'm curious for you, after everything you've built over the last 38-ish years, what's the next level look like for you?
By the way, just going back to your last question, I really don't like when lots of stuff is put in my head. So that's like why I'm not online. You know, I sometimes don't even like listening to music.
It's programming you.
I just don't like stuff in my head. I don't like it distracting my thoughts. Like I like to just think.
Interesting.
This is a funny story. To answer your question about Bill Gates, when he was a kid and his mom's like, Bill, come to dinner. He's like, no. She's like, come to dinner. No. And, you know, finally 20 minutes later, she comes up. She's like, knocks on his door. He's like, I'm busy. She's like, busy doing what? He's like, I'm thinking. Have you ever tried it before?
Oh my God. That's good.
And So I think I like to just have space. Of course, I like listening to music. I like, you know, reading. So I like, you know, why am I not online? I don't want a zillion things coming at me. Will I read something interesting online? Of course. Do I read lots of books? Of course. Do I like listen to podcasts? Of course. But I try to do it in limited quantities in the right times, just not have like always like a barrage and an influx of things.
That makes a lot of sense.
So where do I want to go from here?
Yeah. What's the next level look like?
Well, I think back to that Scott Galloway question of like merging your passions and your talents. I mean, I always tell people who are trying to figure out what's next that actually like asking people their dreams or their passions is too overwhelming of a question. I'm like not a big fan of that. Like, I actually think it's just better to ask people like what interests you. I'll just be like, oh, tell me what you're interested in. Like later today, send me a list of 10 things that are interesting. So I think asking what's interesting to them is like a much easier question. Like I could answer 10 things right now in the next, you know, 60 seconds. So could you. Whereas I was like, what's your passion? What's your dreams? Like it's too high pressure and high stakes. I don't know what my passion is.
Yeah.
You know, so I think like that reframing. So really like locking in like, all right, what are you interested in? Okay, well, let's start thinking about each of those.
Interesting. I like that. So I call you the master of events. You're masterful in events. You've done that. You're going to keep doing that. You've done a lot of investing. Is there any particular area you're very interested or passionate, however you want to construe it, for your next level or something big that you're focused on that really gives you energy for this next version of yourself?
Yeah, I like building physical things. I like physical experiences. I like being in nature. I like land. Yes, it will not be like a tech startup.
That self-awareness is critical, man. Look, you're a really interesting thinker. I've really enjoyed this. I'm really inspired by what you've built. It's pretty incredible. So I hope everyone gets to check out Summit at some point. I do think it'll change your life, but thanks for sharing all your wisdom on here, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the World Class Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe across all our platforms. Hit that notification bell so you can get updates on our new episodes, and we'll see you next week.